Hello and welcome to Bone Up, the podcast all about bones, how we make them, why we break them, and if we fully understand them. I'm David Armstrong.
Hi, and I'm Richie Abel. And over this series, we're going to be exploring osteoporosis, bones, what we know, and what we're yet to discover. And we hope you will join us on the journey.
So for anyone keen to learn more about our infrastructure of calcified collagen, this is Bone Up.
Listeners, welcome to the last Bone Up episode of 2024. It's been quite a year. How are you doing, David?
I'm doing well, thanks. Looking forward to getting a few days off over Christmas. And just looking back at all the things we have crammed into the year, both professionally, actually, on our Bone Up recordings as well.
Yeah, it has been a busy year. It was nice that, about a month ago, you visited London and we got to see each other face to face to plan what we're going to do for the podcast next year. That was really a lot of fun. I like that a lot. We visited ECTS this year. I think we got some really great episodes live from the conference. And we got the interviews with Eleanor Tesordi and Roland Barron. It was a really fantastic event.
Yeah, it was great. The weather in Marseille was fantastic. We got to speak to a whole range of people, from some of the most senior bone research people in the world, right through to people doing sort of undergraduate and doing doctorates right across Europe and, in fact, across the world at large. So yeah, it was a really, really good time. At a personal level, I was actually over in London, as well as meeting you, Richie, to attend the Adult Rare Bone Disease Clinical Network meeting, which was good. And my trust in Northern Ireland is now part of that, which is excellent. The ECTS meeting was a big highlight for me this year, but I also had my visiting professorship renewed by my colleagues at Ulster University, so that was nice as well, but clearly they expect more work out of me, so.
There's no such thing as a free lunch.
There's not.
This year seems to have been a very busy year for you clinically as well, David.
Yeah, every year seems to get clinically more busy, I suppose, and I was speaking earlier to one of my senior nurse colleagues, and she was just saying to me that she seems to do nothing but treat people with vertebral fractures now, you know, within the fracture liaison service. And that's certainly a big change. Something we see at conferences, we hear a lot more about vertebral fractures, but even in day-to-day practice, you know, the vertebral fracture is now front and center of sort of driving what we do, and the patients we now see as the highest risk patients and the patients we prioritize largely in seeing. And that, as years go on, I think that the vertebral fracture becomes more and more important, which is, of course, very topical because of our guest today, Professor Ken Poole, who has agreed to talk to us. I'm sure he will talk to us about a range of things. Ken is a man of many talents, but we're hoping he will focus on vertebral fractures and on his insights and research work in that area.
Listeners, we're very excited to announce our guest today. We've been trying to get him on the podcast for a while. He's incredibly busy. We have Professor of Metabolic Bone Disease, Ken Poole, from the University of Cambridge. Professor Poole applies novel imaging techniques to investigate bone diseases in his research practice, and he also runs the NHS Clinical Services for Metabolic Bone Disease. Ken, hi, great to have you today.
Hello, thank you for having me.
It's lovely, Ken, that we've been able to get a window to catch up, so we're really looking forward to speaking to you.
To kick us off with the questions then, Ken, we'd like to get an idea about what your day job is like. We know that you combine clinical work and research work with your special interests. How do you bring that all together?
Well, I think I've probably got four jobs. One of them is being a clinical doctor for patients with osteoporosis, and particularly vertebral fractures and people who've got complex osteoporosis. And then people with rare diseases, of which we look after about 550 people in Cambridge with rare diseases, the particular interest in osteogenesis imperfecta, so brittle bone disease, and all that goes through families. So there's a lot of them. The other hats are I'm an academic at the University of Cambridge, and I do a lot of clinical trial work, imaging work, and studies to try and work out why people fracture and how we can better treat them. And third job, I'm a capacity lead, so trying to bring on tomorrow's researchers with the NIHR Cambridge Biomedical Research Centre. And we've got a current focus on trying to get nurses, midwifery, and allied health professionals into research and support them here. And my fourth job is, well, because my wife is a consultant obstetric anaesthetist, I'm a sort of very busy dad, so lots of drop-offs to school and back.
It's nice to hear you including that as part of a proper job, Ken.
Oh, it's the best.
So we're going to talk today about many things, but significantly about vertebral fractures. We were talking earlier, I was thinking maybe 15, 20 years ago, we didn't hear as much about vertebral fractures in terms of conferences and research and practice. Why do you think we're hearing so much about vertebral fractures now as compared to in the past?
Well, I think you're talking about whether we hear them about them at conferences. I think you and I, in our clinics, we've never stopped seeing patients with vertebral fractures. And it's when someone loses height from a vertebral fracture or has a curved back, that's really the archetypal osteoporotic patient or person with osteoporosis. And once seen, especially when someone's had multiple vertebral fractures and they've lost a lot of height or it's really changed them, never forgotten. And I think the difference between, you know, I've been doing this 27 years, the difference between then and now is that there are treatments that really mean that it should be a never event for someone to have multiple vertebral fractures. And the reason it should be a never event is because we've got medicines that prevent the fractures. And there's always been a real problem trying to identify people with vertebral fractures. And part of the research question is trying to find who those people are and get them targeted to the right treatments at the right time. I remember years ago, it was this incredible, the first ever real epidemiology in osteoporosis from Professor Cyrus Cooper. And it had this exponential increase in hip fractures with time. And everybody was amazed by this exponential curve as you got older. As age increased, the hip fractures got more common. There was also a steady increase in forearm fractures. And then another part of the curve that less looked at was the vertebral fractures. And they started to go up very rapidly after 50. But that was only if you looked for them with x-rays, if you did radiographs. They're all out there. It's just that they come to us late.
Do you think it's been driven, like I suppose like many diseases, you finally get a drug that works well for it and there's naturally more interest in the disease or in the sub-disease, whatever. Do you think this, and this is sort of interesting probably for researchers, is this somewhere where research and new drugs have really pushed clinicians to search harder for patients who will benefit from these treatments and to do better for these patients?
My mentor, Jonathan Reeve, who was my PhD supervisor, he gave the first teriparatide, as is now, or parathyroid hormone treatments in 1972 at Northwick Park, or at least the publication was in 1972 in The Lancet. And that's possibly one of the most effective treatments for vertebral fracture. It took until 2004 for that to become a drug, but it's been a drug that's been able to de-risk someone within about 6 months, such as there's a 90% reduction in severe vertebral fractures with that medication. And I don't think it's, I mean, obviously there was a lot of problems with its price to begin with, it being an expensive hormone drug, but nowadays there are biosimilar drugs to teriparatide that we use here. I think the problem is that there's always been one of the first problems came because radiologists and doctors got together and said back pain should not be x-rayed. I never could understand that, but it came along. And so you have people like Emma Clark and Stephen Kaptogi in the research world who've done great studies to show these are the types of back pain that require you as a doctor or a nurse to request an x-ray or radiograph. and you should be finding them in that way, because the ultimate problem is that some of the back pain you feel with a vertebral fracture seems similar to other types of pain with back pain. And since back pain is so common, there was a thought, well, it's going to be chronic musculoskeletal, the word that covers everything. And actually, there you miss the person who's just collapsed a vertebrae and who could be helped enormously by treatments. And you asked me about the medication. I think that it's fair to say that with newer medications that come along, like bromosozumab, abaloparatide has come, and hopefully there'll be more anabolic treatments like this. Yeah, I think that because they work so rapidly and so with such an enormous effect, then of course it focuses the doctors and nurses' attention on trying to get the patients the treatment quicker, especially if they're at very high risk. And we all know that if you've had one vertebral fracture, the second is you know, what is it, 9 times more likely, and the third is 27 times more likely. Once you're going up through the vertebral fractures, they're like dominoes. So yeah, there's some truth to what you say, but I think that we've all seen the patients who could benefit, and they've always been there.
How similar are the vertebrae to other bones in the body, like the hip? Do they fracture in the same way?
That's a great question. So you've got these 24 out of your 33 spine bones, the 24 of your cervical, thoracic and lumbar vertebrae. And they make that lovely double S shape that we have because we're bipedal and we have to stand upright and support our heads right at the top, which is quite unusual for apes. And so they are formed the same way as the hip. The endochondral ossification, they're formed from a cartilage template, which is then made mineralized and ossified. But there the similarities probably end. You could probably say they've both got a cortical shell, so a hard compact bone shell, like scaffolding tube. And they've both got an inner honeycomb or trabecular bone, which is like the inside of a crunchy bar. But in the vertebrae, it's very much more the honeycomb working with the shell that's giving it the strength. That's the front of it, the vertebral body. And then at the back of all your individual vertebrae, you've got these spinous processes and articular processes. They're the bits you can feel if you lean forward and press on the lower part of your back. You'll often feel that's the spinous process. That's giving you the bony support and protection for your spinal cord and all your nerves. Whereas your hip is this lovely cantilevered arch, transferring the body weight in a ball and socket joint down to your leg, your thigh bone, and really given to compression and tensile forces and lots of torsional forces as well, whereas your spine has a very different loading pattern. And then how they fracture, well, it couldn't be more different, really. I mean, if you fall to the ground hard enough on your bottom, you could fracture a vertebrae. And if you fall to the side, landing on your hip, you can fracture a hip or proximal femur. But actually, that's not how we often see people with a spine fracture break it. It's more often that they're lifting something or they bent in flexion. And that comes back to your background, Richie, about material properties. And the material properties of the hip and spine are very different. So the vertebrae can only withstand a certain amount of flexion loading, or, you know, the compressional loading before it gives way. And it gives way in that sort of non-elastic way for a bit, and then is a complete, you know, failure point. So that sometimes if someone hasn't got any honeycomb, as happens in severe osteoporosis, the whole vertebrae can collapse. And that's one of the things that, you know, we want to know the bone density, because we want to know whether any of the other vertebrae are going to be collapsing in that way. And whereas your hip has got a complex way of fracturing because of its design and shape, it's got some regions which are very, very thin and porous and liable to give way at the slightest, reversal of forces. So when you fall on the side, you reverse the normal forces the hip feels, and therefore that's how you often break a hip.
Is the mechanism of fracture important in terms of a vertebra, or is it something something do you think, you know, we measure, we do a DEXA scan and we measure bone mineral density at the spine. But it strikes me sometimes the mechanism is something that we should, that I wish I knew more about, why people fracture certain vertebrae at certain times. We've all seen patients with T-scores of -5 who remarkably have never broken anything. And yet again, we've all had, I think, the clinical conundrum, Ken, of seeing someone with 2 or 3 vertebral fractures, but a T-score of -1.5. And it strikes me sometimes at the clinic, we're way far behind in terms of the mechanism of understanding how the vertebrae actually fracture.
We are. I mean, I should probably say you've already done in your podcast T-scores and DEXA, but it's worth restating that in someone who's a younger postmenopausal woman or a man of the same age, a spinal DEXA is a really good readout of the strength of someone's vertebrae. It's only when you get into the older range where all those bits I mentioned before, like the pedicles and the spinous processes and all the other bits of the vertebrae get worn and hardened, and you can't then measure the honeycomb parts of the vertebrae with the DEXA. And, you know, some people get very upset locally when they can't have a spinal DEXA over a certain age. But actually, the reason we say you can't have it is because it doesn't give you the information we need on the honeycomb. So bearing that in mind, we don't measure directly the strength, whereas Richie and colleagues at Imperial and around the world, there are techniques which measure the actual performance of a tissue or a structure, or in this case, a bone, under loading conditions. So there even exist at the moment ways of taking images. They have to be 3D images in order to, so a CT scan or a tunnel scanner that goes all the way around the body to give you a 3D picture. And then doing a finite element analysis, which breaks down the structure into little focal elements, and then can subject, if in the case of a spine or a vertebrae or a hip, subject it to the sort of forces that take place when you do give extra force to the body. So when you do bend down and lift up the really heavy end of the sofa or fall sideways onto the floor, you can recreate those conditions in the laboratory using finite element tools. And when you do that, you get amazing results, because you can take someone's bones and virtually break them in the lab, and also see which bits are giving way first. So mm-hmm. So in the case of what turns out to be really useful in humans to work out how their bones might break is spinal finite element imaging. And the great proponent of this has been Tony Keaveney, and his software can take an L3 vertebrae and get internal tissue failure by virtually loading it and virtually compressing it. And you actually see, because of a little color map, you can see the individual elements of the trabecular part giving way at the stress. And you can work out, you could say this vertebrae in this person, you know, its baseline strength was 3,500 newtons. And obviously the really beautiful thing about that is then you can say a year or two later with some treatment, look, its strength now is 5,500 newtons. And that's the difference.
I was thinking about the clinic. Will we ever see that at the clinic, do you think?
Well,
is it useful to have it at the clinic? Will it ever guide us to say, well, you know, I've done your finite element analysis, and I think in your case, teriparatide might be better than Romo or Prolium. Do you think it has a clinical, or is it just something that makes Richie's eyes light up because it's such an exciting way of looking at bone?
Well, I think what you have when someone comes in, particularly if they've had a vertebral fracture, is they've got no confidence in their own bones' ability to withstand simple acts of daily living, and they feel, you know, when's the next one going to happen? And it is, in my experience with the patients coming to me, really an awful event in their life. So, you know, is everyone going to get this? No, but but there are some things that are just quite a long way along the towards finite element modeling, like 3D QCT, which is a method that's gaining a lot of traction of measuring the trabecular, the honeycomb bone density, which gives you, it's not miles away from the finite element readouts for how strong the bones are. And you can start to look at that and say, yeah, actually you had a okay, to go back to your question, David, you had an okay T-score, but let look inside your honeycomb. And actually what's going on here is that the trabecular, the honeycomb bone is not as strong as we thought. And therefore, you know, where we were sitting on the fence and wondering whether you should have a bone building therapy first, now we're sure. And we're actually doing that right now. I mean, because we're very blessed in Cambridge, I think we've calibrated, or Dan Chappell in the team and Judith have calibrated every CT scan that we can reach within miles and miles of Cambridgeshire and the Fens. If we find a CT scanner, we go out and we calibrate it. And so if someone says to us in Kings Lynn or Norwich, I've got a CT already done on this patient, because we calibrated it, we can get the image exchange portal to send us the pictures and say, right, yeah, we'll do the QCT, which is, it's not quite finite element, but it's along the way.
Once it's working in a number of people and it's shown to be useful, then industry, commercial companies can get behind it and then work to develop better scanners that can then go into hospitals to fill the need.
Yeah, I mean, and it's worth saying that the great majority of our current research in this area is just done on ordinary scans done for other reasons. And we've got a buy one, get one free project going on. Where if someone's coming in, we've got sort of six scanners in Addenbrookes, and if anyone picks up a leaflet as they go through, it's going to ask them safety questions about having a CT scan, and then it's going to ask them, the second page is going to be what you've covered in another podcast, which is the FRAX questions, and then big capital letters at the top, would you like to know your bone health, because we can do this for free. Using the CT scan you're about to have, whether it's to look at your gallstones or your kidneys or whatever else, or your bowel, we can use that. And because we've captured the questions beforehand, we can then add that all together and then plumb the results of the QCT into FRAX and give someone a personal 10-year fracture risk and also some treatment advice about, you know, and we picked up lots of people with spine fractures and lots of people with osteoporosis in that way. So, that's really, I think, where it's going to come from. And in China, they recently published in 70,000 people a reference range of QCT. So when you overlay the results from the QCT as well, it looks exactly the same as it does in the big, huge Indian reference range. It looks exactly the same as it does in the US reference range. They just overlie one another. There are very few differences in how people's honeycomb bone, the trabecular bone with QCT, changes with age. And that comes to you, Richie, because the actual three-dimensional density maps so well to the Newton strength of the vertebrae, it's really nice to get that readout and be able to know where someone is in terms of the strength of their vertebrae.
It's fantastic. And the vertebral structure, as you described earlier on, is relatively simple in comparison to other bones. So it's quite suited to the modelling. CT scans are fantastic for capturing the distribution of the bone, the thickness of the shell, the amount of trabecular bone, etc.
I think we should probably say that we wouldn't ask for a CT scan over a DEXA scan because of the radiation involved in taking the CT scan, why it's sort of a nice little add-on, or as I say, a buy one, get one free, rather than the first line thing that we should all be asking for.
It's a really wonderful way of getting more data from the patients and, I guess, opportunistically screen them for a disease. What kind of uptake do you get when people read the forms? Do people overwhelmingly want to know what their bone health is?
We had a lovely result from our... We had this sort of free text entry part of the form where people were given their form and they're sitting there with their pen and they were writing. And we said, what do you think of this? And overwhelmingly, people thought it was a great idea. They've explained it in multiple ways, which we're analyzing, which is really nice to do. So you got that. And then at the end of a year, if they'd had our Phoenix pathway, then they were, you know, 5 times more likely to have been found to have osteoporosis and 3 times more likely to be on medicines. And we were really pleased with that, but we want to do better. So we've run the whole thing again for another year, where this time, instead of asking GPs, would you take this bone information and go through it with the patient? One of our peer reviewers said, well, why aren't you doing it yourselves, you lazy people? So we actually just fed the people who were the high risk into our ordinary and very stretched clinical service, and to see whether by the end of a year we can actually bring that up to more like the 5 or 6 times. And because if nothing's done, then nothing's found, and that's the sad bit. But yeah, the uptake's great, and people, this was running during COVID. I was the only person from my team still in the hospital on the COVID ward, but I was running down to still put the little invites in next to the in the CT scanner, because that was still running the whole time. And even during COVID, people were really happily just filling in that bit and posting it through our little box. And they were happy to have that extra information.
That's an episode by itself almost, isn't it? How we kept osteoporosis services running during COVID when they seemed less important to the rest of the world, but we were the voices crying in the wilderness that you still have to pay attention to people's bones.
That's right. And they'd managed to keep going with denosumab and treatments like that. People were busily injecting themselves at home. But we learned a lot.
And you coped with the clinical service, because I think that's the thing that always worries me a little and worries the team I work with when I think of new ways of finding even more vertebral fractures that we didn't know about, that it will, you know, overwhelm the service that we have.
That is the million-dollar question. And the simple answer is it does completely overwhelm the services. And I don't know if you've ever covered this in the podcast series about machine learning and approach to finding vertebral fractures. But nowadays, you can point a neural network or a server, you could just get every CT scan ever done. Now, say we've got 50,000 of them a year in our hospital. And you can point the machine learning algorithm at that and say, could you find me every single person with a vertebral fracture anywhere in their spine, please, and give them to me in a list? And Cass Javed has been testing a huge commercial system with this. Now, you turn it on for 3 months and you have an absolutely overwhelming number of calls of vertebral fractures. And it's, in a way, purely, you know, the pure software engineering part of it, it's great. Well, well done, you found those. But in terms of what you do with that, because you have to go and look at them, you have to go and verify them, you have to see whether there was anything else going on with you. There's no screening there. There's no saying, oh, I'm already on a zaledronate, or I'm already taking the alendronate tablets, or do you know what I mean? It's a huge issue, and we're all in it together to try and work out who we see and how we see them. I think it's going to involve some patient-centered patients themselves or hospital attenders saying, yeah, I'd like to know this, and I'm going to go to this portal and I'm going to enter my clinical information and simple information about whether I'm on a medicine, so that down the far end, when it hooks up with the machine learning outputs, it's not going to just be as it was in with Optasia in Nottingham. 850, I never forget it, 850 patients in 3 months when we were going and using the Optasia, which is another way of looking for vertebral fractures with a machine learning technique, with that active shape modeling technique from Tim Coutts. It's just incredible. And it is, there's nothing wrong with it. There's literally nothing wrong with it. That was perfect. But you imagine trying to tell your FLS team you've got another 850 patients to follow up in 3 months.
Yeah, exactly. It's the big challenge, isn't it? As some people say, you need to break a service to get more funding and to, you know, and others say you need to sort of build it organically, and it's never easy.
What's the real barrier to you and your clinics providing better healthcare? Because it feels like there's a really good understanding of the biology behind fractures. There's technologies that are available that can get really good data, then AI and computer and software technologies that can use that data to identify people who've already fractured, maybe even predict who's going to fracture next and where they're going to fracture and how they're going to fracture. What's stopping this taking off?
I think so in relevant to that, we audited the time taken to get just a patient from the general practice onto one of these therapies, which is supposed to be maximum of 16 weeks by national guidelines. And our average was 35 weeks. If you were unlucky enough to come into the hospital with an agonizing vertebral fracture, which is, I think there's 30,000 a year in England and Wales now, you got onto the treatments within 20 weeks. But no, not the 16 weeks that's required. And the problem is, if you, and this is the problem across the NHS, is that specialties in the NHS are either silo specialties, which are got a nice fence around them, or they're down the bottom on the ground specialties where there are no fences. And bone health and bone care, osteology, as David calls it, is a down on the ground specialty. And it can be, and to get onto one of these medicines, one of these de-risking medicines that turns your risk away very, very fast, requires a specialist. So it has to be a specialist initiation of the medicine. So there's only a limited number of us now. But because we are not fenced, there's not a fence around what we do. We see everybody with everything. And in a hospital like mine, it can be everything to do with the musculoskeletal system. If there's a new transplant being done in Papworth, or there's a new or the new leukemia induction that causes avascular necrosis in young people, then all those patients come towards, there's something wrong with the bones, let's send them to the bone people. And in a system where you were able to expand to meet demand, you would increase the supply. But actually, in our specialty, there is no expansion to meet the demand. And so we are ending up, I suppose we're having the same conversation across the UK, and it was the case at the rare bone disease meeting that Emma Duncan was mentioning, that you have to make these really difficult decisions. I'm going to look after the patients who are really sick with the rare bone disease, and I'm going to have to look after the patients who are really sick with the multiple vertebral fractures. And some of the other things that are coming through, even though people are shouting louder and louder, particularly post-COVID, in ways that I never would have imagined pre-COVID, if we're going to keep it free at the point of delivery, then we're going to have to try and put a fence around what we can do. Otherwise, everyone's just going to get upset and the times are going to get much longer before people are seen.
When you talked, maybe to change the topic slightly, you talked about patient-centered care and what this means to the patient. I think the two things in terms of vertebral fractures that patients say to me over and over at the clinic, one is their loss of height and how that changes their body shape.
Yeah.
But the other is pain they get from vertebral fractures. And pain stands out to me with vertebral fractures more than wrist, more than hip, more than anywhere else. Is that because we just don't do well with pain? Or is there something different about vertebral fractures and the nature of the fracture that is intrinsically more painful?
That's a great question. I'm going to bring it back to my son. Four weeks ago, was pushed off a box in a drama class and broke his wrist, had a buckle fracture of his wrist. And I could watch just how he couldn't move it. And I could see the image, the radiograph of the fracture. And what your natural thing to do there is to not move it at all until it's cast, or he didn't need an operation, thank goodness. But you would sometimes fix those bone fragments surgically, or you'd put them in a cast and stop that moving until the process of healing is. And I think what I see and you're describing with a vertebral fracture is that you have an actual fracture in your spine and you cannot keep it still. And the worst thing that can be done is completely lying flat and not moving in this situation. But that way it takes an enormous amount of pain relief and mental fortitude when somebody's vertebrae is painful and fractured to actually be able to keep still enough for it to start healing. And it will heal in the end, but I can never believe how poor the data quality is for what to do in this situation. When you get a set of national experts reading out what to do, all they do is say, well, that doesn't work, and that doesn't work, and that one doesn't work. And we've looked really carefully at that one, and that one doesn't work. And as physicians and even the surgeons who do procedures, they sort of say, well, we've got to do something. These people are in agony. So that's why I think you cannot stabilize these spine fractures. And I think those of us who've looked after patients with vertebral fractures would love and welcome the best MSK symptomatic vertebral fracture pathway. It's one sheet or one PDF, and it takes the person from fracture right through to how they're managed. And best MSK is sort of taken up by Get It Right First Time. It's an NHS thing. Today in the news is Martha's Rule. It's just very personally important to me. Has just come out for people able to get that call off and say to people, my child or my relative is much sicker than you think, and I don't think you're taking it seriously. And you make that call to Martha's line, and that's helped people get a second opinion and often treatment for sepsis. But in this same way, if someone's out there and they're struggling with a vertebral fracture and they're being told, have some paracetamol, to me, it's a never event that someone should have that vertebral spine pain and not be able to access the things that are needed to try and improve it. Yeah, so the best MSK symptomatic spine fracture pathway takes every part of that care through to how it should be. And my managers tell me it's an aspirational document, but I think aspirational documents are great for starting out and to improve things like that.
Yeah, I find myself sometimes, because people will ask, you know, will this injection improve my pain? And you have to be honest and say to them, this is not a pain-killing, one of the bone-building injections. You know, you say this is not a pain-killing injection. And obviously you have to be clear about that. And then sometimes, you know, patients will take that on board. Occasionally their face will fall and you know, you think, I wish I could promise you that this is a pain-killing injection. And even though we talked about time pressures on clinics.
Yeah.
You know, we're focusing very much on the bone, but I do find myself then spending time and prescribing for pain as well and trying to manage the pain as well at my osteoporosis clinic and at my FLF service. And I'm sure you do as well. You know, you've tried to be a good doctor, but I feel I have less tools and less ability and less data behind me to do that.
Can I bring up one of my little eccentricities here?
We'd be delighted. We're all friends here.
So another thing that happened in lockdown was I've had the colleagues, Dr. Adrian Crisp and Juliet Compston and Jonathan Reeve, I was lucky to train with three greats here in Cambridge. And they, Tim Cox as well, the enzyme, the Gaucher's expert who works in lysosomal storage disease, they all use permidronate and Adrian in particular used it as an analgesic in acute vertebral fracture. And one really good randomized controlled trial was done by Arminjiat. And it was given as a single dose after a vertebral fracture compared to placebo with the pain scales done at regular intervals to see. And it was quite clear from this one RCT that it worked. And I've always been using a single dose of permidronate before I start other things in acute fracture pain. And I only have one RCT to go in, but it's my eccentricity here that I have a special patient information sheet written about that drug. It's 90 milligrams. And I was so cross with how it was treated, that RCT, because it was a sole piece of evidence that, you know, and it doesn't stand up to get through all of the national guidelines, that I found Dr. Arminjiat, who was working in New Zealand during lockdown. And I managed to get a one-to-one with him on a video call. And he's great. And I just said to him, right, I went through the whole procedure, the whole, you know, what were the patients like? How did you do it? How did you infuse? Do you trust that this drug was genuinely reducing people's pain? And the answer was yes. And so So in a placebo-controlled trial, I do think we have something that can help them. And with enough time in the world, I would love to redo that study. Because I love single studies like that. When I was doing my PhD in 2000, I gave a single dose of zoledronate, the Zomi, to 4 milligrams to people after a stroke. And it was only me and Liz Warburton. We did the whole thing together at a trial versus placebo, measured the bone density at 6 and 12 months. And we could show that a single dose of zoledronate stopped them losing their bone after a stroke. And 20 years later, the great Dr. Katya from Cornwall has put together an NIHR proposal to try and do the definitive study. And it wasn't for our want of trying, by the way. We had 5 rejected grant applications to try and turn that into a proper study. But yeah, so there's my eccentricity. I like pomidronate, as did my illustrious and brilliant forebear, Dr. Adrian Crisp.
And that's following on then with a bone-building drug, presumably,
yeah,
in appropriate circumstances.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah,
that's very interesting. Dr. Aminjat, if you're listening to the podcast, get in touch, and we'd love to speak to you.
I will have to say that the background of Dr. Aminjat's current GP clinic in New Zealand looked absolutely gorgeous. So, yeah, watch this space.
I guess the listeners at home are going to be clamoring now for this research to be done.
All right, crowdfunding, yeah. So yeah, it's I hope that so what we did, I remember this the zoledronate study so well, was we went to Dr. Cummings, Steve Cummings, who'd done all of the great alendronate and raloxifene studies with Dennis Black and in UCSF San Francisco, and we got together with his team and worked out how many people would have to give a single dose of zoledronate to in order to prevent fractures and work that out. And it wasn't terribly expensive, but sometimes, as you both know as researchers, sometimes it's just either not the right time, or I didn't write it correctly, or we just none of us could get the funding for it. So the fact that it's Phoenix is the name of my study, because it was from the flames of not 4 rejections for the opportunistic bone density analysis with CT. But that title's already been used, but we should Phoenix pomidronate and Phoenix zoledronate after stroke. So, yes.
I've got one last question for you. I've seen you speak many times at conferences, and I've been to visit you in Cambridge. A thing that really comes across is how much you care. You care so much for your patients and also for the people that work in your lab. And also you have this role in the BRC developing young academics. You give so much of yourself to other people while simultaneously managing complex research tasks and complex clinical tasks and making time for a podcast. What is your secret? Because you always seem so calm and practical in the way that you approach everything.
The single secret. Well, easy answer. I'm a Christian, so that's the easy answer for that part. But if any of them worked, any of those people who work with me know anything about me, it's the utter chaos of the all those tasks overlapping one another and never being able to complete any one of them, and always being way behind on just about anything you can think of. Other secrets are, I just work with great people here clinically and in research. And one little gem of being in Cambridge and is if you end up, there's this thing where we've been finding people who've lost their intervertebral discs due to a weird and new genetic condition. And then you look up all around the world, who's the expert on intervertebral discs and this particular gene, and then you look it up, and it's a neurosurgeon for dogs who works in Cambridge in the Cambridge University Veterinary School. And when you look at, we did another one with a rare condition, hypophosphatasia, and who, you know, we needed to look at the mineral structure of the bone, you know, and we look around, who is the one person who can do nuclear magnetic resonance imaging of bone and understands its complete complex molecular structure? It's Melinda Dewar, up the road in University of Chemistry in Cambridge. So one of the things you care is you just get great and lovely people around you. And I think we get a really large amount of them here. And to say that my clinical colleagues and nurses I work with here, say this to David a wee bit, because everyone knows what it's like in the NHS at the moment. I think you just couldn't come in every day if it wasn't for your nursing secretary or, you know, the clinic team down there. You're sort of holding on together, aren't you, at this sort of stage?
Absolutely, yeah. It's all about the team working together and working for the benefit of patients. I know that sounds like a corny thing to say almost, but it's true, you know.
It's absolutely true. It's really easy to do this kind of research because you just know how good things can be. It's like someone hearing that, someone who could hear that music and know that it was, I could be better. It could be more. It could always be better, and that's what drives you, I think, to try and make the clinical services better. And they get a bit annoyed with my passion here in Cambridge, but it won't stop.
Yeah, I think that's very important. If people realise you're passionate about what you do, it actually can carry a lot of things. Even with managers, sometimes they see a glint in your eye and they know you really care about it. And yeah, it's. I think if you lose that, then you've really lost something. So continue to inspire people, Ken.
Do my best.
I also know where you keep your secret stash of chocolate biscuits in your clinic as well. So that didn't come up, but I know that's important.
Yeah, I'm going to... A whole separate podcast is how to run a clinic, where to store your coffee flask, where to store your snack, how to go to the toilet without people glowering at you because you're taking a break.
You know the Corrigan's secret door? Yes. The story of many years ago of the doctor in Dublin who had two doors to the clinic so he could go out without patients seeing him leave.
As a young scientist working in a faculty of medicine, I very quickly realised that if you want a meeting with a clinician, take food and you'll get their undivided attention.
Yeah, but dairy food with lots of calcium in it. And yeah.
Ken, it's been lovely, lovely talking to you today. We're going to have to get you back on the podcast again. I'm sure the listeners are really going to enjoy this episode. Patients and professionals alike, thank you so much.
Guys, pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Ken. It's really good to talk to you. And we really enjoyed that. Thank you.
David, I really enjoyed the interview today. I learned a lot. What were your takeaways?
Yeah, goodness, Ken covered so much. It's hard to even begin to summarize the things that he said. Just now, fresh from it, thinking about it. The history is always important in these things. You know, he mentioned the first time PTH was given to a patient was back in the early 70s, and yet it took more than 30 years before that became a drug which we use every day, and how important it is to learn, not just, you know, in the lab about new drugs, but learn about the process of how we translate science into medicine, how we move drugs from the planning stage into getting them to the clinic. And just look back 5, 10, 15 years, even how vertebral fractures have become more center stage and see how we could do things better, you know, because there's no doubt if we look back 20 years, I'm sure we would have wanted to promote the use of osteoanabolic drugs more than we've done. And, you know, Ken a couple of times mentioned just, you know, just of the history and his training back 15, 20, 25 years and the people he trained with and the things they brought to medicine. So just how that's, you know, it's important to be reflective on where we've come from as well as where we're going. The other thing, I suppose, as a clinician that sort of blew my mind a little bit is that idea where you can sort of virtually recreate a patient's actual bone structure and then virtually apply load to that bone and watch the bone breaking or watch the bone resisting fracture and put different pressures at different angles. To my mind, the day that I can sit in a clinic and say to the patient, you've just had a scan next door, now let's look at a real model of your bone and let's stress it and let's see if it's going to break or how it's going to break. That strikes me as amazing. And I know we're nowhere near that yet, but these are the first few beams of light coming over the horizon. And you know yourself how quickly things move on in science and medicine. And, you know, perhaps before I retire, there'll be something at the clinic that I can use for patients, maybe not for every patient, but certainly for some patients, where I'll be able to virtually stress patients' bones or virtually stress real models of real patients' bones and share that with the patient and be able to use that to sort of to feed into treatment. That's real translational medicine, which is really, really exciting for me. And I suppose the other little thing Ken mentioned about just giving IV pamidronate to patients immediately after a vertebral fracture, the benefits you get from pain relief, and also obviously some anti-resorptive effect there. We talked a little bit more research needed in that area. But it's interesting that, you know, that's a throwback to maybe 10, 15, 20, 30 years ago when IV bisphosphonate was used in that setting. And it's interesting not to forget about those little things, that they may still have a place in the future. So, yeah, lots and lots of really exciting and interesting things to take away and think about, and just be inspired by Ken's enthusiasm and calmness for all this. Well, what about you? What did you take away primarily?
My big takeaway is that the field of osteoporosis research is very advanced, even at the clinical level. You know, here we've got Ken Poole, who is a clinician and an excellent researcher, combining those jobs together, working at the very cutting edge to try and develop better diagnostics and better treatments for patients. I think maybe a lot of people don't appreciate how forward-thinking and how cutting-edge osteoporosis research is. The software programs that you use to take a CT scan of a bone and model it in 3D and load it and simulate the fractures is the same software that they use to design aeroplanes and racing cars. This is really advanced technology being applied to osteoporosis, and importantly, in a clinical setting. There are lots of researchers using these modeling tools, they're called finite element models, in engineering research around bone science and orthopedics. But there are not many people actually doing it in clinical practice. It's like the edge of the edge, if you like.
I always go back, Richie, and we talk about this a lot. The first time we met, you said, you know, I'm not sure if I believe in osteoporosis. Or if it exists. And, you know, when we do that sort of, we had that sort of discussion today, and we were talking both during the interview and after the interview as well, about how vertebrae develop differently, how they fracture differently, how drugs work differently in vertebrae than they do in hips, for example. And even though we like to draw a big circle around all of this and call it all osteoporosis, in many ways, the cause of vertebral fractures, the detection of vertebral fractures, the technology we would use to detect and improve and predict vertebral fractures, the drugs for vertebral fractures, are actually really quite different from all of those variables for, let's say, hip fractures, or for that matter, ankle fractures or shoulder fractures, you know, all very different.
As Ken said today, the bone that you're treating is very different. You know, when he described the vertebrae, and basically you've got lots of trabecular bone, the honeycomb, and a very thin shell, whereas in the hip, you've got a very thick shell, as well as the trabecular bone. And often in the people who fracture, the trabecular bone has been lost or almost lost already. So, you know, fundamentally, it's different types of bone that are fracturing, and you're going to need different types of treatments because the metabolism in those bone types is quite different.
Absolutely. And while it's very useful to have a big circle to draw around everything and call this osteoporosis, within that circle, you know, there's lots and lots of different areas and different treatments. And certainly from the clinician's point of view, and this seems to come up with more and more of our interviews, there's more and more need for bone specialists in medicine, you know, because a lot of osteoporosis is still done by people who don't really specialize very much in it. And the more we read about this, the more we research, the more complex this becomes. And of course, specialist bone researchers as well.
We definitely need more of those. Well, listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode. We really did. See you next year. Bye-bye.
Very happy new year to all. Bye now.